Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And we go a little something like this. Hit it. I dig it. Come on.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Bowlology Report. Unfortunately, no Bradley Hodge today. He's a little bit busy, but I do have a special guest. He is best described as an international man of mystery. He grew up playing cricket in Footscray, Western Melbourne, went to South Australia, Tassie, England, the Netherlands, America. He's been everywhere. He was Test Cricketer of the Year back in 2001. It's, of course, Funky Cole Miller, live from Las Vegas. How's it going there, mate?
Flam, how are you, buddy? Hey, we had our first 100-degree day today in April. Can you believe it? It's only springtime, but it's 101 degrees today.
And, mate, how's it been? I mean, we're all in isolation. We hope everyone is staying safe and we're getting through this. What's happening over there in Las Vegas? Not much, I would imagine.
Hey, we've been basically, I furloughed all my staff on the 23rd of March, so we've been shut down basically since then. We're a timeshare resort, so we had a few guests staying. We've still got two guests in the hotel now. There's nothing open in the hotel except for two guest rooms and two guests staying in there. And the whole strip is just totally empty. Like, there's 330,000 people lost their job in 2 weeks in Las Vegas.
Jeez. Geez. And just for those who don't know, what's your official capacity over there?
So I work for the Marriott Hotel chain on the timeshare business. I run the facility engineering side of things. So officially they call me an assistant chief engineer, but I'm definitely not an engineer. I'm definitely not an engineer.
Don't worry about all that study, Funk.
No, just come to America and get a job.
We're going to have a real chat about your career and go all the way back to when you started. Well, even pre-Footscray days, I believe you went to kindergarten with another Australian cricketer.
AIC Dottomade.
What were your early thoughts about Tony Dottomade?
He didn't have much of a run-up in those days. He couldn't really bat to save himself, so he had to develop his bowling early. Worked on his batting as an older kid. His second year in primary school, he really went ahead leaps and bounds.
And what were you providing back then? Because the word on the street, i.e. from Dodders, that you were a superstar.
My only memory from kindergarten is I was playing on the old blocks one day, and in those days they didn't care about having rounded edges. And I remember that I tripped over, and the next thing I knew was my kindergarten teacher was pulling a block out of my head. missed my eye by about a centimeter. I still have a scar that runs down my eye where it went in right here.
So your coordination in the field was set up pretty early at kindergarten then.
Yeah, hence I fielded fine leg my entire career.
Yeah, that's what I've always said, Funk, with this isolation, without taking the mickey too much. We fielded it fine leg for 20 years in self-isolation. So we're used to this, aren't we, ex-fast bowlers?
I'm thriving in this. I mean, I don't like people to start with, so this is a blessing for me. I get to sit at home all day. They've put me on swing shift during this whole thing, so I'm working afternoons now, 2 p.m. to 10:30 at night. So I get to lay by the pool in the morning, walk the dogs for a couple of hours, and then come to work in the afternoon and sit in my office and pretend I'm working here.
Hey, so we'll get back to the cricket, but also you were fine baseball? You know, what level did you get to baseball-wise, and what sort of effect did it have on your cricket? Because, you know, no doubt you always had a really good slower ball that turned into your spinner, and you're a, yep. Although you didn't make a lot of runs at first-class test level, there was a high percentage of sixes over right field.
Yeah. I was pretty good baseball. I was probably a better baseball than I was ever a cricketer. In reality, I was throwing the ball around at 90 miles an hour when I was 16 years of age. So I was playing all representative baseball from the time I was, I think, 12 up to 17. Then I got I missed the under-18 championships in my final when I was 16 years old because I got glandular fever. And I never really played baseball again. That's when I really started to concentrate on my cricket. I played a couple of years down in Geelong winter comp a few years later, but really at the age of 16 and a half is when I started taking cricket as my first sport.
And even when you got older in the field, Funk, the one thing you always had was a great arm.
Yeah, I think some people just naturally have good arms. I think I was just lucky. But, you know, as I said, I was a pitcher in baseball as well. So I'd been throwing from the time I was really 9 or 10 years of age. So I think that muscle just develops over all those years of throwing a ball.
What about Footscray? Very famous club here, noted for their fast bowlers, isn't it? Like from Alan Hurst onwards and around your era, not only Tony Dodder made your old kindergarten teammate joined you. Mervyn Gregory Hughes was there.
Mervyn Gregory Hughes, Lenny Belkin, who played for Victoria and Queensland as well, left arm quick, great all-rounder. Peter Dredge, who played a lot of first-grade cricket, could have played a lot of first-class cricket, if not for the time that Victorian had a lot of fast bowlers in that era. Rex Bennett was another guy that was there who was getting a lot of wickets in first-grade cricket. Won a premiership for them, Rexy.
Used to bowl on the nets to the Aussies, didn't he?
He did all the time. That was one of my funny things. When I played my first Boxing Day test, I put the pads on and Rex turned up with a brand new Kookaburra. Got me out about 19 times. Just demolished me. He was like 60. He was 63 at that stage.
So it must have been tough getting a game in the ones at Footscray back then.
I took my brother's place. My brother was actually probably the fastest bowler in Victoria around that time. I remember a story that he tells all the time that he was bowling against Dav Watmore in a club game, and Dav came up to him after the game and said, "You're the fastest thing I've faced for 5 or 6 years." And Dav was in the middle of his first class career at that stage, playing against some pretty fast bowlers around the country. So it was a pretty big rap for my brother. But he just wasn't one of those wicket takers. He had the pace, but he just couldn't take a wicket. So I ended up taking his spot when I was just turned 18. I got my first game at Footscray in the ones.
Was it like the famous Steve and Mark Waugh when they replaced each other?
A little bit.
Who'd you come in for, and you pointed to your brother?
Him. He was. I was always known as his little brother until I played first class cricket, and he became my brother.
And was there much family history in cricket? Because your father coached you in the juniors. Was he a cricketer, or got involved because his sons were playing?
No, Dad was a cricketer. He played at Sunshine Heights, where me and my brother both started playing cricket as well. My brother's got like 13 hat tricks, starting from under 12s, under 14s. I know. Apparently, so I've heard you say a few times. You know, what I was watching the other day was Warnie dropping that catch again. Second hat trick. It was all over the internet on your birthday, wasn't it? I thought you must have re-released it.
But back to your bro, 13 hat tricks.
I grew up so jealous of my brother because you get a hat trick, they mount the ball for you. He had like a wall of cricket balls. He had figures like 7 for 1, 6 for none. Yeah, you know, I got my first hat trick, I think, when I was 15 or 16. I think I got like maybe 4 in my career, but it took me a long time. It took that's like 35 years. But my dad coached both of us when we were young, under 12s, under 14s. And then when Dad went down to coach Footscray Juniors down there under 16s, I followed him down to Footscray. And then we won our first under 16 premiership that first year. We had a really good team. Dad was a ruthless coach. So we batted first made 450, bowled the other team out for 100, batted again, made another 250, then sent him back in. And we got him out for like 80. No. They gave up in the second dig.
How many days did they go for?
2 days. We had a very good team. The whole team that I was playing with, we were all playing in all the third or fourth grade district cricket. So we were playing all the local comp sides, and we had a team full of really district second, district thirds and fourth cricketers playing under 16. So we dominated.
Superpower. So, Funk, you're playing for Footscray and you do well enough. You get picked to debut for Victoria. And I think you walked out, you might have batted first, Victoria. You walked out at number 11 and your old kindergarten mate was down the other end. Tony Dodder made on 60-odd not out. He'd never scored a first-class 100 before this day. Can you take us through your thoughts facing that first ball? No doubt conscious of getting your old mate to his first-class 100.
Yeah, I was trying to get my first boundary as quickly as I could as well. I was so nervous playing my first game of first-class cricket because I'd been to the MCG for years to watch the Boxing Day test and first-class cricket there. And even though you're walking out of the MCG and there's only a bunch of school kids down at third man, it was just pretty exciting for me. So I probably wasn't thinking too much of Dodder's getting 100. Probably more of just maybe just hitting the bat or hitting the ball.
And can you talk us through that first delivery? I believe Ray Bright had got out the captain and he was pretty keen for you for the rest of you guys to make it hard for them and battle it out. I think it was Brett Mulder, an off-spinner, threw the ball up.
I don't remember it very well, but I remember running down the pitch about 8 or 9 yards and then realised he'd just beat me in the flight. So I thought I better swing the bat anyway. And I swung the bat around, I fell over and dislocated my right thumb. And we hadn't even bowled yet, so they had to tape my thumb into place so I could bowl in the first dig.
And I looked in the stat. I don't think – did you bowl in the first innings or did it take to the second innings?
No, I can't remember. I think I bowled because I remember having the tape on my thumb. They basically put a ball in my hand and taped my thumb in place.
So stumped first ball in first-class cricket and you dislocated your thumb.
Yeah. Good start. Ray Bright was also my club captain at Footscray. So I basically, you know, the old MCG rooms, you walk through, there was the upper deck viewing area, then you had to walk down the stairs. And my first game, I was sitting under that staircase. Dodders had already stitched me up, so I wore my travelling uniform to the first home game. He thought that was really funny to make me do that. And then all I heard Ray Bright say, and I hope you got a bleeping button, was I walked through the front door, so no one has said anything. Then all I heard from Spotty was, "What the fuck was that?" I said, "Oh, well, you beat me in the flight. What do you want me to do?"
Just got a good one early, as Merv used to say.
Yeah.
It was a competition for spots in Victoria as well, wasn't it, with the ball? So where did the move to South Australia come from?
Really, it was Dennis Hickey came on the scene in Victoria. And so I played that first game. Then we went to South Australia. No, I think I played two games against Sackers and Western Australia in Victoria. Then we went to South Australia for the last game of the year and Dennis Hickey came in to the team. I was made 12th man. Which I wasn't too upset about because really, you know, I took a week off work. I got $300 to get, well, $250 or something to play the skilled cricket, and I'm in the best city in the world to be 12th man. So I didn't see much in my hotel room.
What was the feedback from the senior players about being a good 12th man back in the mid 80s?
A good 12th man always got home late. Just made sure the drinks were ready and you bought the first round when we went out at night time. I had to scout a few bars for the boys every night, so I thought I did a pretty good job, but then. The next season, though, I wasn't even in the Victorian squad. So maybe my drink mixing wasn't that good after all.
Bit of a
but then I went to, yeah, something did me wrong. I think it might have been, it was either Dino. I think it might have been Dino that stitched me up. I think he said it was all about stay out late, get the drinks in, you know, just make sure you turn up to the game the next day sort of thing. And so I took him to his word. I spent
but your
my
coach was Ian Redpath, who wasn't a big drinker or nightclubber.
Correct, yes. And, Dennis Hickey was my roommate. The funny thing was he borrowed my clothes every night and went out every night. He was playing his first game. So he was wearing my shirt, my pants.
And he owns half of New York now, Dennis Hickey.
I know. Exactly, I know. I don't know how well he's doing right at the moment. He does owe me. He owes me a nice yellow shirt with a little round collar on it. And I had a little, I think it had pelicans or something on it. It was a pretty cool shirt back in those days.
And Funky, did anyone from South Australia approach you, or did you just go on your own will?
I went over. I went over on a weekend, and back in those days, they televised all their Shield games. So I sat in my hotel room one on a Saturday afternoon and watched a Shield game. Shane George was really the fastest bowler they had.
Yeah.
Peter Gladigo was bowling, and that was really all they had up there at the time. Maisie was their spin bowler, but I really thought, having a little taste of first-class cricket, I thought I was going to be good enough if given the opportunity. So I really went home, left work, quit my job, drove to South Australia, found somewhere to live, got myself a job working for the newspaper selling advertising over there, found a cricket club. So I went to Sturt. Les Stillman was coach, but I went there because Wayne Phillips, an Australian cricketer, was playing there.
Oh, yeah.
And I wanted to play cricket. I wanted to play cricket with an Australian cricketer. I didn't know at the time how funny the guy was.
He wouldn't have let you down either, Flipper, would you?
He's probably the funniest person I've ever shared a dressing room with in my life. He's just hysterical. There was never a minute without a story going by, and he just teased and terrorised the younger guys in the team.
And your time in South Australia, you took a 7 for in a Shield final, backed it up with 40 wickets the next year. Like, you were a genuine swing bowler back then, weren't you?
Yeah, and I think in bowling in Adelaide and Oval, as you would know, Flem, playing a lot of test matches in the first class cricket there, if you bowl from the scoreboard end, even though it's into the breeze, it really helped you back in those days when there was no grandstands back there, really just had the Bradman stand. You could, with the hard ball early on, you could swing it quite a long way. And I liked bowling from that end because I felt like it was more running downhill into the wind rather than uphill with the wind from the other end. I never really got balance from that other end. But the funny thing is that Shield final where I got 7 for, I went out after, I tore my grunt muscle in about the 23rd over or something.
Oh.
So 5 of those wickets I got were with the slower ball. Guys was missing, were just swinging through and missing them and getting bowled or popping them up the mid off. So, we got the 7 for, you think, well, bowler's night out. So I went out for a night. With a couple of the other guys, and I might have stayed out a couple of hours too late, but nothing too bad. And then we got bowled out the next day, so now we've got to bowl again. And I'm taped from the waist to my chest, and you've done that muscle as well, Flem. It's the most painful thing you can get. And Hooksy is the captain of South Australia, and he's not the friendliest bloke in the world when he's grumpy. And he'd heard that I'd been out late, so he threw me the new ball and said, "You're bowling this end, and you're going to bowl this end all day." Second dig, and I'm thinking, oh, well, okay, let's go. So here we go. Well, mate, I went through so much pain. I ended up bowling like 16 overs on the trot with the torn rib muscle. I can't remember. I think I might have got 1 for 50 or pretty good figures or something on the whacker. But, and then I got written up by South Australia. I got put in file. I got put on notice that wasn't going to be in the squad next year. And thankfully, that all got sorted out. And, I had 2 or 3 good years in South Australia.
And so that moves us straight into the move to Tassie. Was it a similar sort of thing that you could just see an opportunity in the fast bowling ranks there?
Yeah, same thing. South Australia were starting to think of playing more all-rounders and another spinner. Maisie was struggling at the time with injuries and he really couldn't run and do anything else apart from spin the ball a mile. So Peter McIntyre was heading over to South Australia. Joe Scuderi was the all-rounder. There was just going to be limited opportunities for me. So, after playing as Tassie in a Shield game just before the end of the season, Greg Shippard and I had a chat, and Greg was coach of Tassie, and he said, "Look, I think you've still got the ability to play first-class cricket," and I thought I did it as well. And he said, "If you want to come down, no guarantees, but we'll look at you after the first couple of games and we might put you in the squad and see how you go. So basically the same thing. I quit my job again, found a club, Lindisfarne, which didn't exist at the time. They were a brand new club into their first grade cricket. I was there professional, earning $75 a week. And they got me they made me a housemate for somebody, and then just went from there. I played field cricket after the first three or four games.
So in this mix of South Australia and also Tassie, you know, we need to talk about league cricket in England. You're a smashing success. In particular, when I put it out to social media, the amount of ex-Lancashire League players that were asking about your time there and how much you enjoy it. But, for us lucky enough to play it, it did develop your game.
It does.
What were your first memories? And then, of course, you're most probably famous for, I won't get into off the field, for on the field, for doing the double, 1,000 runs and 100 wickets at Rawtenstall.
Yep.
I think you're only the third person to ever do that.
Yeah, there's four of us now. What's his name from New Zealand did it as well?
Chris Harris.
Chris Harris, yeah, Harry did it. But, yeah, I loved, and you know, Flem, how much fun it is playing cricket in the leagues in England. And I think in the times that we played over there, we played in really strong leagues. Every club either West Indies, and it was just really, really good cricket. The amateurs were, I think, a class above. They probably are now. It was tough cricket. And you learnt, as the pro, you bowled from one end. If it was a 48-over game, I think they were back in those days, you were going to bowl 24 from one end, yep. And you expected to bat three or four and make a 50 or 60 every game and get a team through to victory. So it teaches you a lot as a young kid. I first went over there when I was like 21 years of age, to Preston in the Northern League. Had an all right sort of year, but nothing great. They fired me. The next year I went to Chorley in the same league. Again, I think I got 75 wickets or something, but I just couldn't make a run at that stage. So they fired me. Then I had a year off. Then I went to Rawtenstall in the Lancashire League. And in that first year, I did the double, and it was 1,000 runs and 100 wickets. And you've played there, Flynn. The ground's not the biggest ground in the world, so it suited my batting.
No.
It was a pretty hard wicket. We had a really good young groundsman, so he would roll the wicket hard and bouncy and fast. So when I was bowling off the long run back in those days, I could nip the old Duke ball all over the place.
And got a question from Jack Simpson, who used to play in the leagues there. Was it true?
My famous wicket.
Offered... Oh, we'll talk about that first.
Yeah. So Jack's a grumpy bastard too. But I was playing for Accrington, and it was going to be my last time I was going to play league cricket in the league. So I'd had enough. I'd been there for nearly 10 years. And we'd been bowled out for 50 or something. They were going to get him. So Jack, I got a wicket earlier. Then Jack came in, and last ball, they needed two runs, I think it was. So I just said to the umpire, left arm over, quick. He said, what? I said, I'm going left arm over, quick. And he just looked at me and just sort of smiled. And Jack took strike and didn't know what was going on. I came off the 25-yard run-up. And I could do it, so I knew I wasn't going to be making a fool of myself. But it just a perfect ball, seam up. It started outside off, nipped back to middle, then nipped away and took the top of off stumps. Jack played forward and took the loft bail off. So that was it for me for Lancashire League cricket. One ball left arm, one wicket.
That's the biggest. I mean, we see Jofra Archer warming up with his left hand, but you were doing that in your Australian career, weren't you? And you were doing, you're taking a bit of the Shane Warne instead of a different delivery. You were talking up that you're going to bowl left arm spin in a test match.
Yeah, I remember, I'm not sure if you remember, we were playing a Shield game in Victoria, and I think it was against New South Wales, and I think it was against Queensland, they were a million. And Pistol said to me, you want to bowl left arm now? You can bowl left arm quick if you want. And I just couldn't bring myself to do it in a Shield game. I just thought that was taking a mickey too much. But if the offer was put out to me, and I thought about it for a minute, I thought, no, I better not.
Oh, jeez, I'd love to have seen that. Just one of the highlights, you won if people don't know the Lancashire League, to win the Worsley Cup is massive, isn't it? It's a round robin knockout, and you won it at Rawtenstall. against Baker. Roger Harper was an unbelievable professional, wasn't he? 7-2 fields. I remember my first game. I hit him inside out over cover, ran one, come back for the two, thinking, and he ran 30 metres, dived and caught it. And I'm walking off and the three old guys go, he's fallen for it again, Roger. It's an absolute setup. But in this game, you didn't get a lot of runs and you took 9 for 25 in a final.
9 for 25 and Andrew Payne got the 10th wicket. We brought him on just to keep up one end so we wouldn't get a wicket. He got a wicket in his first over.
Was it early or?
Oh, no, it was late. It was like the 8th or 9th wicket. Yeah, so we brought him on just to give our other quick rest and said, oh, Andrew, just bowl a few balls, just keep him outside off. And I think the idiot nicked one to the keeper and he caught it. So that was disappointing,
My 1-9 for Enfield in the Lancashire League, I had the first 8 wickets. And there was a mix-up with the run-out and the guy ran from square leg and the crowd, because you got big crowds back then, didn't you?
Yeah,
they're all absolutely yelling and all my teammates are yelling, don't run him out, run him out. The keeper didn't even go to the stumps, right? The keeper refused. But this bloke at square leg ran up and took the bails off celebrating and wondered why no one was going up. I had the first 8. But
I think I had 7. Yeah, there was the collections, you remember back in those days, Flemmy, right? For the finals, it was at Bacup. It was our local derby because Rawtenstall's just down the road, about 2 miles. I want to say there was 3,000-4,000 people there. The collection I got, and Peter Wood made 50 batting for us, a Lancashire League legend. I think he got like £150. And we're talking almost 30 years ago. I got, I think, £140, which for the pro to get that much money was a huge amount of money back in those days because people like to give to the amateurs more than the pros. Definitely. But £140 30 years ago, I can tell you what I bought a lot of. It was a Scotch and Coke and beer.
What was the nightclub next to Rawtenstall there?
There was the Queen's, which is called Stickies, in the Queen's Stickies Hotel. Stickies in the pub on the corner. Yeah, they didn't have a bar fridge. If you remember, they just kept their beer in a box behind the bar. And when you got the bottle of beer, they just picked up a bottle, took the top off it. So I used to hate drinking warm beer in England. It used to drive me insane.
And they loved you there. You were that social. Matthew Mott went after you and they loved him. My 2 years at Rawtenstall had a professional who smashed them everywhere but wasn't quite as social, Michael Bevan. They could not work him out.
Bevo would get his collection, put it in his pocket and go home.
Well, he got out one game and he must have had his keys on him because he walked straight to his car and drove out.
and the thing is, the house that we lived in at Rawtenstall, you would know, was literally 50 yards across the road. Because I used to drive to the ground as well. I used to drive across the road. I used to drive to training. Sometimes I couldn't drive home. The thing I love about those days, Fleming, I'm sure you had one or two of these guys at your club over there. They would come to training just to get away from the wife. They wouldn't train. Then they'd put their whites on for training. They'd sit in the bar until 9:30 at night, then get changed and go back to the wife. And they'd say, oh, is that cricket training or not?
No, it was a great time and a great, I think, challenging and training time for developing cricketers. Yeah. But We need to move to, Tasmania. You had 1 year where you got 40 wickets bowling outies, but it was the record-breaking year, 1997, 98, 70 wickets. You took the most wickets ever in Shield. And this is where you started to mix up with spin. You know, what percentage of that 70 was outies? What was spin? And what about the build-up to it? You obviously lead cricket. You were bowling a lot of offies.
I played in Holland. I was playing in Holland by that stage and I was still signed as a medium pace bowler. But during the week, I'd stretch out. We played on mats and they spin a lot. So I'd stretch out a mat during the week and I'd get a bucket of cricket balls and I'd just bowl off spin for a couple of hours every afternoon. So I did that probably 3 days a week for 5 months before I went back to Australia and said to Booney, I think I can be our spinner. That's really what we lacked in Tasmania. We had plenty of fast bowled medium pacers, but we didn't have a spin bowler. So really Booney said, look, if you want to bowl a few in the pre-season, you can have a go. I bowled one or two overs at the end of the previous year against Victoria, and Ian Harvey tried to slog me, but he just kept mishitting me. And then I got someone out bowling a lefty. I can't remember who it was, but bowling around, we got bowled in behind his leg. So it got one to land on the footmarks and spin back around him. So Booney thought maybe you can bowl a bit of spin. And once
I
knew he
was
on
that game, I think Dino played and said you're the best domestic spinner he'd faced all year.
That was the next season. That was during the year I got the 70 wickets. That was at the MCG. I got a five and a six for down there. And really, that's when Dino came out and said, yeah, this is the best spinner I've faced for, you know, who knows how long. He's the best off spinner in Australia. And we know that he was friends with some of the selectors back in those days. So he was probably the guy that first brought me to attention of the media, which is pretty important when you're trying to make those Australian teams. And that's probably when people started to sit up and pay attention. But, you know, Flem, when you have those good years, Flem, and you've been through this, you get a ball in your hand, you just think you're going to get a wicket every time you bowl. And that whole season was just incredible. I just felt like I was going to get wickets every time I bowled.
What about mentally? How did you get used to having the confidence to bowl at that level? But also, you know, when you get hit for six as a fast bowler, you might come back and bowl a bouncer. Yeah. You know, from a spinning perspective, you don't have that option.
In all reality, not many people hit me for six when I bowled a spin. I bowled at 96 kilometres an hour, so I bowled at a pretty good click. And at that pace, I got a lot of drift, and then I could turn it. So, and when you're bowling that fast, you're not really tossing him up, so there's no time for people to run down the wicket at you. And that's what Dino probably realised initially. He tried to come at me a couple of times, but I was beating him in the flight. And the difference, my theory for bowling was not to beat you in the flight out of my hand, but to beat you 15 feet away from the bat, so that late dip with the extra speed I was putting on the ball. So that's why a lot of guys didn't come at me. I got a lot of wickets, bat, pad and LBW bowling spin. And I think that was the key. The key to bowling it, though, was I practiced it all the time. In the nets, I'd bowl 45 minutes of medium pace, and then I'd bowl another hour and a half of spin, and then bowl 5 hours of medium pace, another 20 minutes of spin, and just got used to going from one to the other, and got to the stage where I could do it within an over if needed to be.
And was it really just, you know, you had a great slower ball, you know, was that picked up through baseball pitching, like a curve ball? And then, you know, people don't know, in the mid-80s, not many fast bowlers had gun slower balls. You know, Simon O'Donnell and Steve Waugh picked up later. So was your basic stock off spinner your old slower ball?
Yeah, and I had really small hands as a kid. So when you throw a curve ball in pitching, you're supposed to put your two fingers together and rip across the ball. Well, I couldn't grip the ball that well, so I just dropped the ball back in my entire hand and rolled all my fingers over the ball, and that's how I threw my curve ball. So bowling spin, I had a bit of a slinging action when I was young, so my bowling arm would go behind my back a little bit. So I would just drop the ball back in my hand. And you know, Flem, because you bowled a similar off-spinner as well, it actually was probably the fastest ball you bowled as far as arm speed. So that's what the rest of the deception was, but it came out 25 miles an hour slower. And that's where the other deception was. We got guys hitting it straight to mid-off or just playing and missing it by 2 feet.
No, totally agree. Fastest bowl you could bowl. Yep. Quick arm speed, but your fingers and wrists weren't behind the ball. I remember facing you in that 11 wickets you took at the G, and you were fast, but you weren't flat. There was a lot of overspin. So there was drop, there was curve, and you just didn't want to just go forward and try and block the ball front foot, because then you were just so vulnerable to that back pad you were talking about.
That's what I wanted you. I wanted you to try to defend against me, because I knew I was accurate enough to have a short leg there and he'd be pretty safe 99% of the time. I wasn't going to kill my short leg or my leg slipped. So, yeah, and like I had this argument with Ashley Mallett all the time. Rowdy was all about throwing the ball up in the air and getting a loop on it and everything. Well, you know, I'm 6 foot tall. I'm going to let go of the ball. I'm 8 foot tall now. Well, I don't know any 8 foot tall batsmen, so the ball's already above their eye line. The ball comes out of your hand going up anyway, so now I'm 8 foot six. And now all I've got to do is get the ball spinning hard enough that it's going to dip when it gets to your end of the bat. So the old-fashioned way of throwing a ball up in the air and beating guys in the flight, and I guarantee you, while you're in India at some stage, pardon me, there was some old Indian guy came to the nets and bamboozled all the Australian guys by bowling as slow, tossed up off spinners. I just didn't agree with that theory. I thought the more I ripped it and got you to stay in your crease, the more opportunity I had of getting you out.
Well, you reminded me more of the late, great Bruce Yardley, who yep. was also a former swing bowler, also a former pitcher. So there had been someone similar to you in the past, I reckon.
Correct. And he bowled with a split finger spinner as well, another non-traditional off-spinner's grip. So each to their own. You know, I think if you're going to coach kids, you can't cough in Las Vegas with the coronavirus. I'm trying to suppress my cough.
I can't get it through the computer, can I?
I'm not sure. I could take my earpiece out. They say it is airborne for a long, long time. It's so funny because people are so scared. It's allergy season in Las Vegas, so people are so scared to sneeze or cough in public in case, like, people come out of the sky and wrap them up in tape and put them away somewhere. So I don't normally get allergies until I lived over here, but now I've got these burning allergies in my nose and I just want to sneeze and cough all day.
Now, Funk, Australian selection, 33-34, 98 Pakistan. How did you get the news?
You know the answer to this, don't you? So I was in Holland and playing cricket. I was over there as the pro, playing for Haarlem in the first, they call it first class cricket over there. It was their club cricket. And I'd already been picked in the Australian A team. We were going to go England, Scotland, Ireland. And this guy from Channel 7 Tasmania rang me up. I'd had a couple of beers after a game. And he's like, "G'day, Cole." I forget who it was, but let's say, "Hey, it's Paul here. Just want to talk about, you just got picked in the Australian team. What do you think about that?" And I'm like going, "Yeah, I know, mate. I'm going to England and Scotland and Ireland in about 3 weeks' time." And he went, "No, you're in the real Australian team." And I went, "Fuck, you kidding?" But he didn't tell me I was on live TV at the time, though. So that went across live in Tasmania, which is, that's not my fault. When you work in the media, Flynn, you're supposed to warn somebody that you're on live TV.
And what about the trip, mate? It was a remarkable trip, wasn't it? We won there for the first time for 40 years. Yeah. There was no Warn, but Stuart McGill was unbelievable. And yourself, I don't know if it was your first wicket was Salim Malik bowling outies, wasn't it? But then the big wicket was you provided Gills the record catch.
Who would have bet on Salim Malik getting out to a guy blank playing his first test in the fifth ball of his first over?
The odds on that?
Odds are a million to one. He made a fortune. And then I got – then Lazlo Makram caught behind bowling over the wicket to heels, took a great catch really, because I imagine for a keeper, when you got an off-spinner bowling over the wicket to a lefty, he's probably blinded the whole time, and the ball bounced and spun a little bit and heels caught it up there, and one of the photos that takes pride in my bar at home, because I got a hold of the photo, got Heels to sign it for me, and it hangs very proudly in the bar.
Yeah, and there were some pretty good celebrations there as well. But, through the career, do you have a favourite, a test match? You know, you got 10 for against the West Indies in Adelaide. I remember that great victory we had down in Hobart with Langer and Gilly, and you were 12th man, but you celebrated more than anyone.
Well, I always do.
Now, what are some of the memories?
There was a couple of games, like getting the 10 for an Adelaide for a man of the match performance, and like sports are all about winning awards and stuff, but it's just nice. Well, I thought it was nice to win a man of the match, because to me it was the thought that, I really contributed to my country winning a test match. So that was a pretty proud moment for me. I was talking to someone else recently about that summer and Brian Lara, and I was reminded that I got Brian Lara out 6 or 7 times in that summer. So we played him in a first-class game against the Vics. I got him twice there as well. But I think I got him for 185 in Adelaide. It was like 100, it was 146, I think, in Melbourne when I got him. I got him in the West Indies once as well when he was like 160. So I don't think he mind facing me, but I eventually got him out. So I think he was had rabbit ears on him for a little bit.
But he was out fatigued. Hey, you got Stephen Fleming 4 times, though. You got the lefties out.
Yeah, I like the lefties bowling offies. I always backed myself against those guys. But I think my favourite moment in all the Test matches that I played was in Antigua, batting against the West Indies.
Well, you led me in beautifully here because you're a baseballer. I've looked up, Swill, you made 174 Test runs and you hit 8 sixes. So about a third of your runs were in sixes.
And I think and 90 were against the West Indies.
No, I think it's the most famous one. And there was a heap of questions on social media. Mm. Thanks for that. Well, they asked, did Curtly say anything after the second six?
After the – so that wicket was pretty flat. And people have asked me this. It was bouncing fairly – you knew if he bowled it short, it was going to bounce chest high. If it was up there, you could go forward. I didn't think he was bowling that quick, to be honest. But I had one of those days where I was on, even though Warnie had backed away and hit one to the slips, and then McGiller had got out pretty quickly, and Tugger wasn't too keen to get down my end as well. So, man, the first ball I faced was from Courtney Walsh, and it nearly cut me in half. It like pitched two feet out, stood off stump, and nearly hit me in the guts. And I thought, oh, this could be fun. Like, the keeper was standing so far back, I thought, oh, hang on. Maybe this guy is a bit quicker, looks from the change rooms. But I got through that over. And then on the sixth ball, I still fend one off my hip. And Tugger called me through for a single. I'm thinking, hang on, is there two there? He goes, no, just one. So we get the one, and I look around to see who's going to bowl the next over. And it's Curtly Ambrose is standing about 70 metres away. And he looked as big that far away as he did when he stood next to him. The keeper's moved back an extra 4 or 5 yards. Now there's like 5 slips in a gully and a short leg and no one else in front of the field. And the first couple of balls was just, you know, off the back of a length. I just spent back and across and Nads went through the gully and just called one and Tugger called two. So I'm now back on strike. 2 balls later, back and away again. Nads it through the gully, called one. Tugger called two again. Last ball over, just knocked one to mid off thinking not going to run there. Tugger called me through for a quick single, so now I'm facing 2 overs in a row. So I get through Courtney. I get through Courtney Walsh again. Same thing, leg by the 6th ball over. Tugger calls me through for a single, so he hasn't faced the ball for 3 overs. I'm on like 7 not out. Now Ambrose is bowling, and he's just he bowled this bouncer to me, and it didn't really get up that much. But to be honest, I saw it early, and I just swung at it, and it hit the middle of the bat and flame, you know. You hit a sweet ball. You don't need to look where it's gone. You just knew where it was gone. And I never really aimed down when I played pull shots. I always aimed up. So when I felt it hit the bat, I sort of took a quick glance over my – they call it grandstanding in baseball over here, but you've got to see it go over the fence. And it went over the boundary, went over the grandstand, and went out into the street. And I thought, well, I got that one pretty good then. And Steve Waugh just came down and nearly just burst me out laughing, and Curtly Ambrose – I could feel him standing behind me, but I didn't want to turn around and look at him. No, so I just kept my head down. Tugger said, good shot, said thanks. Walked back to my mark and sort of took guard. And then all the, you know, the windy started chirping, put him on the ladder, Curtly put him on the ladder. And I'm thinking, oh, he's probably going to bowl another bouncer. So he went around the wicket, which was even scarier. And he bowled me another bouncer from around the wicket. And I just did play the same shot. I got it even better this time. And I hit this one. I even said to myself, oh, that's gone. And that went in front of square over the grandstand again. And by this stage, Curtly's breathing down my back. I know he's there. I can feel him standing right behind me. The West Indian crowd are pretty excited because they like to see sixes hit. And I'm thinking, I'm in trouble here.
Yeah.
Well, they love a hook shot, yeah. So then he goes, I get through that over. I get through the next over. I'm still on strike. So at this stage, we've put on about 40. I've got 39. Tugger's faced 2 balls so far. And he goes off the long run. He goes back over the wicket. And you just see he ran in fast this time. And he dropped it short. And I saw it. And it was shorter than any other ball he bowled. So it was going to bounce off my head. I'm having a crack at this one. I got a top edge. It skimmed off the top of my helmet. And went one bounce into the sight screen for just before. And Tugger came down and said, mate, that ball nearly killed you. I said, yeah, but I saw it early. I really should have made 100. I kicked myself. I should have made a test match 100. Oh. So I saw off Walsh and Ambrose, and a freaking Jimmy Adams got me out. Caught at mid-wicket. The only person in front of the freaking that wasn't on the fence. He bought me a long hop. I was so tired from hitting Curtly for 6 that my forearms are cramping up. I hit a straight to mid-wicket out.
Yeah, but you're probably the only test cricketer that can say that against Curtly Ambrose.
I had fun that night. Dizzy was cranking me up in the casino there. And I was AB was our chairman of selectors back in those days. And I didn't know he was standing behind me. And the boys were cranking me up about hitting Curtly in front of square for six a couple of times. And I was sort of bagging AB for never having done that in his life, let alone get him off the square. And only to find out after about 10 minutes that AB was sitting right behind me.
He's hit that very well. That's gone. That is a huge hit by Miller. Out of the ground of Curtly Ambrose. He'll boast about that.
Just 18 months later, you're Australian Test Cricket of the Year.
Yep. Again, amazing. If you vote for yourself often enough, amazing what can happen. You always
got to give yourself. Mark Waugh always said that to me. Junior was big on that.
Give yourself at least one. But I had a pretty good year. I had a couple of test matches. It was really enjoyable. That night was memorable for a lot of reasons, but mainly one for I sobered up in like 2 seconds was the first thing when they announced that I finally won it after the count back with me and Slats. Because we were drinking.
Because you're not expecting it, are you? Yeah, we're all on the same table, weren't we?
Yeah, and every time one of us got a vote, we had to drink what was in front of us. I was drinking red wine. So I'd probably had a bottle and a half.
It was a stitch up because, if you remember, we were sort of the B graders. And I'd played one day as at the start and got like 4-1 votes. So that's four skulls. Then Damian Martin come in late. He's the B grader. He got votes at the end. Darren Lehman got Shield Player of the Year. And then you win Test Player of the Year.
I know.
And I had mates texting me. They knew what we were doing early, but to get up there and make a speech, Bunk, was amazing.
It's almost like when you get pulled over by the cops, and even though you've done nothing wrong, you've been driving, you just pretend, you act like you're sober. Even if you haven't had a drink, you just pretend, I'm sober. I didn't do anything wrong. But I knew I'd had a lot of drinks because, you remember, they put us in that holding room before we entered the room that night as well. So we were in that other place having a few drinks. I had a few beers and probably a scotch or two in there. And then another bottle and a half for red wine. And so then I had to make that walk because we weren't in the front tables where, you know, all the winners were supposed to be. We were in the middle of the room. So you got to navigate. You've got to put your jacket on, make sure your tie's on straight, navigate your way up to the stage with step to walk up to. Then you got to try to talk sense to Richie Benner. So getting the fact that even on TV, you still want to make a fool of yourself in front of Richie. I ended up thanking my dogs, who were both called Richie and Benno. That's my highlight of my speech. I'd like to thank my dogs, Richie and Benno. Everyone, what's this guy talking about? Yeah, it was good.
I'd love to process Richie's thoughts at that stage. But talking about making a fool of yourself, I wouldn't say you'd done that. And also harassing West Indian fast bowlers. We've got to talk about the blue hair. New Year's Day test match.
It's a Flemo, it's amazing. And you know, you get a lot of Indian fans when you're on social media, and I have quite a few. And I imagine you have probably a lot more than I have. But I get sent that video once a week, and it's 20 years. And people still send it to me and say, hey, have you seen this video before? I'm going, well, yeah, a couple of times. Someone actually sent it to me yesterday. It was doing the circle again. After you forwarded it to me in the afternoon, I'd seen it early that morning. So it's really funny.
Really?
I get it all the time. But the whole story behind that, and really I started dyeing my hair. I had blonde hair in Pakistan in my first tour, because on that Australia A tour, Jason Gillespie and Dean Hills had a bet about something that if whoever lost, Dean Hills, who was worked in a bank those days, wore the short-sleeve white shirt and the tie done up and the glasses and everything, and he had to get his ear pierced, which was totally against banker's rules. And if Dizzy lost, he had to bleach his hair white. And Dizzy had his hair shaved back in those days. So he had like half-inch long bleached blonde hair. And I went along just for the laugh. And the place was full of these good-looking girls in the salon. So I got my hair dyed as well. Just so we could hang out for an extra hour or so. And then so I went to Pakistan with white hair. The next year, I honestly never played one day cricket for Australia, and I thought I was going to be a chance that summer. And I really wanted to play. And my thought had been all along, MCG or the SCG on a Friday night in the coloured clothing with green or blue hair in front of 50 or 60,000 people under lights would have been fantastic. So when Steve Bernard announced the one-day squad at the end of day one, and I wasn't in it, I thought, oh, my God, there's my opportunity to have some fun. So I really just – I rang the hotel straight away and got the concierge just to order a hairdresser for me and just tell her to bring in some hair dye. And, like, she just happened to bring in sky or dark blue, whatever we want to call it, Australia blue.
So it could have been any colour that she brought in.
Could have been any colour. She just happened to bring in blue. Imagine if she had brought in peach or something really, really outrageous. So it took me hours to get that done. I had a mate of mine staying in my room from Melbourne, Paul Burns. And we were sitting there having a few beers, and my girlfriend at the time was there as well. And we sort of the process is you've got to bleach your hair. So we're sitting there drinking a few Crown Lagers, and Paul was drinking two to my one. And we did the bleach blonde, and I thought, oh, that looks not bad. I can handle the blonde. And then she goes, oh, we'll do the colour now. And that's got to stay in there for like 45 minutes. At the hotel in Sydney, if your living room wall was a whole wall of mirrors, and by this stage, Paul Burns has had probably 15 Crown Lagers. I probably had four or five. And I remember I took the towel off my head for the first time and saw the blue hair. And it was probably the bluest thing I'd ever seen in my life. And I thought to myself, I might have gone a bit far this time, Funky. But, you know, I put up with it. Paul just fell off the chair laughing. And my girlfriend was just, I think, seemingly cried. But I thought, how am I going to get away with this in the morning? So we went to the ground in the morning. I just didn't go do a warm-up. I sat in the back of the team bus and had my floppy on and my tracksuit with the collar turned up and sat in their room and had a can of Coke and a smoke and had a massage. And Tugger came in and said, righto, boys, I think Casper was playing that game. Casper was going to bowl the first over. And I said, mate, I got to bowl the first over. And he said, what are you talking about? And I took my hat off and said, I spent $350 on my hair last night. There's 25,000 people outside need to see this today. So Tugger changed the team plans and let me bowl that over.
And obviously the great vision is Courtney Walsh, isn't it? And there's great commentary from Michael Holding and Bill Laurie. But what about Walsh's reaction?
Well, Rudy Kurtzman was the umpire at that end, the South African. And when I handed him my hat, I was just standing next to him with my hat on, with my cap on. And Courtney Walsh is, you know, not the fastest bloke to take strike. He's looked around the field. He's looking at the leg, short leg. There's no one more than 30 yards away from the bat, but he's observing the field and he's marking centre again and looking around and marking centre again. And Rudy's saying, give me a hat. So I'm just waiting for Courtney to get ready. Courtney finally looked up and I handed my hat to Rudy, walked back to the mark and started to run in from the first ball. And that's when Courtney really looked up to see me. That's when he pulled away and just started laughing. And what you don't hear in that video, the footage that you see, is Courtney Walsh walking down the Rudy Kurtzman when he walks in and says, who's that man bowling to me now? Making sure who it was.
Oh, absolute gold.
It was a good laugh. It was never done to take the mickey out of the game. It's just me having fun.
I am lost for words. What is that?
Well, it suggests that he's saying, I'm Colin Miller. I bowled. Courtney Walsh is laughing. You can't believe it.
No, and I loved how Steve Waugh was a great captain that way, isn't it? Like, I loved him as a captain where if you had an idea against the team plan, he backed players who backed themselves, but he didn't mind a bit of fun either.
Yeah, and that's what I always say when I get asked the difference between Mark Taylor and Steve Waugh was, in my opinion, Mark Taylor, everyone knew it was his team and he made all the decisions and he sort of set the fields for you. He'd win the toss and do what he wanted to do. And I think Tugger, when he became captain, really gave everybody in the team an equal voice and an opportunity to have their say. And I think that really helped a lot of young guys coming to the team as well.
Funk, a couple of last ones here. A lot of the questions were, are you involved with USA cricket? Are you got your finger on the pulse over there?
Yeah, well, I've been here for 12 years now. And when I first got here, and I've been coming here for like 17 years now, USA cricket was going through a lot of scandal. It had been suspended by the ICC a couple of times. So when I moved here in 2008 and really back here in 2009 permanently, it was still suspended. And I had been approached by a couple of people who said they were involved with cricket in America, but you never really knew who they were. Then I was officially approached when they had an Australian guy come over to take over as CEO. And he asked me if I'd be interested in coaching the team, which I was. But my issue was there was no guarantee you'd ever going to get paid over here. There was no guarantee of the support of all the states. In the US, the West Coast where I live is a lot of Indian-based cricketers. And on the East Coast, it's more West Indians, some Indians. And in the middle of the country is a mixture of all sorts of people. So the factions were fighting against each other. So it would have been nice, but I just wasn't. There was no security there for me. Now since the IC took over a couple of years ago and put people in the right place, then brought some coaching over and got their setup sorted out, it seems to be running pretty well. Now they've got official one-day status now and T20 status. So it's a game that's going to take off eventually. The T20 form will boom over here if it ever takes off.
One from left here, even though you grew up in the western, suburbs of Melbourne, you're both for Essendon, but when the Bulldogs, Western Bulldogs won the premiership a couple of years ago, after the game, Tom Liberatore mentioned you after the game. It was bizarre.
I want to get some of the drugs he was on during that game because, seriously, and again, that was sent to me literally as it happened. And then the AFL got a hold of me, their publicity department, and they sent it to me, and they wanted me to respond to Libba. So I did a response from the roof of the hotel right here, a response to Libba. But yeah, he was on some good medicine that day.
Oh yeah, it's always good to win the Astros Test match.
What did you do today?
Hey,
what did you do today?
Made 100.
You made 100. Yeah. Who'd you face?
Oh, fucking Colin Miller.
You just bopped him?
Bang!
Bang! Beautiful. Bloody work, man!
He was. And just to finish up, yourself and Cindy in Las Vegas, obviously we're going through some tough times here, but you've set up a great place for yourself over there. How many Aussie visitors, friends, come and see you?
A lot. We've had a bunch this in the last probably 6 months as well. But I'll tell you what, anyone wants to come to Vegas when this thing is all over, I'll buy you your first beer. This town is really, really struggling. When you rely 95% on hospitality and visitors from coming around the world, and we were on target this year of getting close to 50 million people come to Vegas to basically see, as you know, Flem, you were here last year to see one street. You take 50 million people out of that street for 4 months. As I said earlier, 330,000 people so far lost their jobs in Vegas, where, for example, all the hotels here are looking maybe to start taking bookings on June 1. But that means that no one's going to be here until July. So that'll be almost 6 months that the town's been shut down. And it's just devastating. Where we live, Flem, there's a casino across the road. And they do a food bank on a Thursday. And they used to open at 11 a.m. They've changed it to 8 a.m. now. But people line up in their cars from 4 a.m. in the morning. And they're lined up for probably, I measured it two Thursdays ago, easily probably 7 miles back on the road, just waiting to hopefully get some food packages for the family. Because what people don't realise, Flem, is this town, people here work for minimum wage, which is in Vegas, it's $7.50 an hour, plus tips if you're a waiter or a barman or a server. So if you and your girlfriend or you and your wife and you've got two kids and you're paying rent and you're working for $7.50 an hour plus tips, you're not making a lot of money. Then you don't get paid for 5 months. And the unemployment system over here has been inundated that people have now been out of work since March 23rd, still haven't received an unemployment check. So the city's really going to struggle to come back from this.
No, I think on behalf, for all of us, isn't it, that, in Australia, we seem to have done it pretty well, but for you guys over there, and there is some industries that are thriving, but, the majority are really struggling. But Swill, thanks so much for chatting on the Bowlology Report today. Some great memories. You're a fantastic teammate, great personality. Thanks for the chat, Funk.
Flem, thank you. And as I like to all your fans, I know you have a massive following down there. Sorry, Hodger couldn't make it, but I know he had another issue to take care of. So that to him for me. Hello to all your fans. And again, any Australians want to come to Vegas, not hard to find. Look me up. I'll buy your first beer for you. Funky Cole Medina.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.